Hi, I'm Marco Werman, host of The World. I am so proud of the work our team has done in the past year. And as we look ahead to the new year, there are many more stories we want to bring you. Stories that focus on the people at the center of global events, helping you make sense of all of it through the noise, giving you the insight and perspective that you rely on with The World. If you've already donated, thank you. Your financial support and messages mean everything to us. We have just a few weeks until our December 31st deadline, and we're still short of our goal. If you have not donated yet, I hope you will today to help us get one step closer. Visit theworld.org/give to put your name on the list of people who support The World. Thank you very much. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky speaks to America, not by video link. This time, he's in Washington.
No, physical presence matters. It's immensely powerful that he's coming in person.
Also today, the Taliban decree no women may go to college in Afghanistan. An engineering student there says it feels like her world has ended.
There is no more oxygen for me to survive. But I will try my best to be hopeful and I will work on myself.
I'm Marco Werman, and in Ghana, a new library aims to reframe Africa's photographic narrative.
The insider perspective will always be different from somebody coming in and telling the story. I don't say that people shouldn't, but I think more opportunity should be given to Africans to be able to tell their own story.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us today. For the first time since Russia attacked Ukraine last February, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is on an overseas trip. He came to Washington. He's meeting with President Biden, and he's addressing a joint session of Congress. It's a visit loaded with a lot of symbolism, and with us to help us understand what it means is Dora Shamiak. She's the president of Razem for Ukraine, a nonprofit dedicated to supporting the country's war effort. Dora, why do you think Zelensky is coming in person to Washington at this particular moment?
It's immensely powerful that he's coming in person. And I think the reason is there's been such strong bipartisan support across all of America for a quick victory in Ukraine, for essentially the basic principles of sovereignty and freedom. And that's really what our organization, the Razem, has been about for the past 8 years, is building a more prosperous Ukraine. So I think having Zelensky come 10, 11 months into the full-scale invasion and having Zelensky come to the United States as the first place that he's coming is immensely powerful. And I certainly hope it'll result sort of more weapons faster, please, thank you, is sort of the short message.
So there's that powerful in-person symbolism. If we're talking about lobbying Congress and the White House for material help, what can Washington provide to Ukraine that it has not offered yet? Like something, for example, that Ukraine could really use that it does not have on the ground right now.
What we've seen at Razem is just immense support. We have donors from every single state who have reached into their pockets and made contributions to support Ukraine today. And I think what that shows is there's a will and there's a recognition that this is important for the world community. And so what the U.S. can do is continue their resolve for democracies and rule of law by providing the kind of hardware that people in Ukraine need to defend their sovereignty.
How does your organization, Razem for Ukraine, actually work to support Ukraine and its citizens? Are you both lobbying for the country in Washington and raising private funds across the U.S.?
We do a lot of different things, and we've been doing them since we were founded in 2014. We work to educate and advocate on behalf of people in Ukraine. We do that by amplifying voices from Ukraine in conversations around the world. That includes on the Hill. So we do that in a lot of different ways. Simultaneously, we raise funds that we convert into things that people in Ukraine need, and we put those in the hands of those people. Specifically, we've been collaborating with a lot of international organizations to deliver various hospital equipment and medical supplies. We've been supporting over 100 NGOs and ad hoc groups in Ukraine.
Generally, Dora, what are you hearing about how Ukrainians back home feel about U.S. support for Ukraine throughout this war effort? And are Ukrainians, do you think, expecting this visit by Zelensky to amplify U.S. support?
Oh, absolutely. Certainly when I was in Ukraine most recently at the end of July, every single person I spoke with really wanted to make sure that every chance I got, I conveyed their gratitude and thanks for the support that the United States has been providing to people in Ukraine. And that support, yes, it comes in the forms of weapon systems. It comes in the form of dollar donations that are then converted into things that people need. But it also comes in the form of moral support, the flags that I see all over Washington, D.C. and parts of New York, the blue and yellow flags, the concerts, the awareness, these interviews. People in Ukraine really want to make sure that people in the United States understand how grateful they are to know that they're not alone, that people are paying attention, and that they're providing the support.
Dora Shomiak is the president of Razum for Ukraine, a Ukrainian nonprofit dedicated to providing support for Ukraine through the war effort. Dora, very good to have you with us today. Thanks for your thoughts.
Thank you very much for the conversation.
Later in the program, we pay a visit to a small town in Vermont where a couple is sponsoring Ukrainians fleeing the war and helping them settle in New England. There's already been a lot of criticism after the Taliban announced on Tuesday that women and girls will no longer be allowed to go to university in Afghanistan. Not surprisingly, the move is deeply resented by Afghan women, as the world's Shirin Jafari reports.
A television anchor in Afghanistan held back tears as he read the news. Following the order from the Ministry of Higher Education, he said, female students were not allowed to enter universities today. 18-year-old Varunga found out shortly after she had finished her final exam for the semester.
Yesterday, everything was fine. Just suddenly, when I get home, then my brother told me that your school's banned.
Varunga didn't want me to use her full name because she says she's afraid of potential retaliation by the Taliban. She says she doesn't know what to think now, after years of studying hard to get into a prestigious university for a degree in civil engineering.
It was my dream to be an engineer. I would like to construction buildings, roads, bridges, because we really need engineers in Afghanistan. But unfortunately, I feel like the world has ended. There is no more oxygen for me to survive.
The Taliban had already banned girls from attending high school. They also prevented women from taking most jobs outside of their homes. Just a few weeks back, Taliban leaders said women were banned from going to public parks. All these policies stem from the group's strict interpretation of Islam. Today, the Minister of Higher Education, Mohammad Naeem, tweeted that Islam does not allow women to get an education. This is contested by most Muslim scholars. In fact, all Muslim-majority countries do allow women to go to school. Afghanistan is the outlier. Afghan entrepreneur Sara Bahidi says Taliban leaders have been talking about forming two separate types of education in Afghanistan.
One, which is the normal one that we see everywhere in the world, law, technology, engineering, all of that. Then we're going to have the women's education. What is that going to be? Childbirth, women's surgeries, immediate concerns, Islamic teachings.
Those fields are acceptable to the Taliban because they help enforce other restrictions, such as no male doctors providing services to women. Bahidi says since the Taliban took over her country more than a year ago, every day has been a struggle for Afghans.
It's just like a wave of trauma, of shock that's passing through them.
20-year-old Rabia, who also didn't want me to use her full name, had 1 year to finish her studies at Kabul University. She's a psychology student and tells me now she sees no future for herself in Afghanistan. Rabia says she planned to take English classes, but those have been closed to women as well. I had big dreams, she says. Now we can't study, we can't go to the park, we can't work. It's like we're prisoners. Adila Mohseni advocates for women's rights in Afghanistan. She says the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and the problematic deal the Trump administration signed with the Taliban led to this moment. It was a shameful deal, she told the BBC's Persian language service. We lost our country, our home, and even our bodies. The fate of millions of Afghans are now in the hands of a terrorist group, she said. Students at several universities protested the ban on women's education today. At Nangarhar University, male medical students walked out in support of their female classmates. The Taliban have responded violently to these kinds of protests in the past. But Warunga, the engineering student, tells me she will remain defiant.
Now I'm very hopeless and sad, but I will try my best to be hopeful and I will work on myself.
She plans to continue her studies at home. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
In Susan Sontag's well-known essay On Photography, she wrote that to collect photographs is to collect the world. For many years, the collections you and I most often see are curated by people steeped in a mostly Western photographic tradition, which is what makes a new photography library in Ghana so remarkable. It's filled with photography books and films by people from Africa and in the diaspora. Paul Ninsen is responsible for creating the Daikon Center, which just opened in Ghana's capital, Accra, which is where he joins us from. Paul, this new library is a project I know you've been passionate about for some time. What does it mean to you that it's now opened?
I'm so excited about it because it's an opportunity to give Africans and Black people opportunity to learn more about their culture and also be inspired about the visual culture.
Why do you think collecting and showcasing the photographic arts and documentation of Africa, why is that so important?
Because then you'll be able to understand if you don't know your history, right, you cannot progress. So my joy in these things is to have a place where people could be educated in terms of the narrative and be inspired to create their own narrative.
And how do you see the current kind of photographic narrative that's been told by many people about Africa, not just Africans? I mean, people from all over the world who come to Africa and kind of show what they've seen. Why do you see that as problematic?
The insider and the outside perspective will always be different. The things which we hold dear and see as our own will be definitely different from somebody coming in and telling the story. I don't say that people shouldn't, but I think more opportunities should be given to Africans to be able to tell their own story.
And that story has existed for many, many years in Africa. Where have those photographs been all this time?
The independence of Ghana, all those visual history of Ghana are not accessible for Ghanaians or Africans to be able to learn from some of these things. Some of these things are mostly on the Western side of the world. That is why I created Daikon, to be able to collaborate, bridge, work with people, to be able to give these tools and these history accessible to Africans.
So the bulk of the collection, I gather, at the Daikon Center is made up of your own collection of 30,000 photography books. What kind of books are we talking about, and who are the range of photographers represented?
So one of my favorites is Gordon Park. You know, I bought it on Lower East Side in New York. And my goal, and I want to work and seek donations and be able to raise more money to buy more African books and African-American books as well.
Gordon Park's obviously the legendary African-American photographer. So it's not just African photographers per se from the continent. Who is represented from the continent? Who stands out?
James Bano, who is a photographer from Ghana. He has 3 books and I have all of them. We have Malik, also from Senegal.
Malik Sidibe?
Yes, I have some of his books as well.
So the photography library is called the Daikon Center, as I said. What does Daikon mean?
Daikon means take the lead.
And what would you like the center to take the lead in?
There are problems in Africa. Problem of accessibility, problem of visual culture, problem of job creation and other things. So for me, I want to inspire people to take the lead, and I'm taking the lead.
How do you see photographs solving some of the big problems that Africa is facing today?
Because, you know, sometimes we neglect economics from narrative, right? If today you type Africa in New York Times, what would you see? How would that narrative help an investor to invest in Africa, right? I did a story in a village where there's no men. Today, if you talk about this, those are the most powerful women who are fleeing female genital mutilation and abuse, right? These are stories you don't see in the major news outlets. I want the Africans to tell their story at their backyard, the good stories, even the bad stories, to even solve problems. So that is why I want to train more people in Africa, give them the tools and the resources to be able to tell our stories in our own terms, in our way, and even and every means to distribute them.
Paul Ninsen is a photographer from Ghana who created the Daikon Center for Photography in Ghana's capital, Accra, which is where he joined us from today. Paul, congratulations on the opening, and thanks very much for speaking with us about the Daikon Center Photography Library.
Thank you so much. I'm grateful. Thank you.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The city of Nogales in the Mexican state of Sonora. It's just south of the Arizona border, and it's where hundreds of migrants are in limbo. They're waiting to hear about the fate of the Title 42 policy, the Trump-era rule that prevents most migrants from coming to the U.S. to apply for asylum. It was a public health measure enacted during the early days of the pandemic and has been used to control the number of migrants trying to enter the U.S. The Supreme Court is expected soon to make a wider ruling on the future of Title 42. Reporter Elisa Resnick of station KJZZ in Arizona is in Mexico right now and joins us with the latest. Elisa, what have you seen in Nogales?
Yeah, when I visited the port of entry this morning, it was pretty quiet. There was the usual lineup of border commuters and travelers, but for asylum seekers, it's still really a big waiting game.
That sounds a lot different than what some other areas along the border are dealing with, right?
Right. Well, Nogales is a much different landscape, and it always kind of has been. For one thing, it's sandwiched between these two big swaths of desert borderland that are really deadly to cross. It's a lot harder for an asylum seeker wanting to present to Border Patrol and ask for asylum to do that here. They have to go to the port instead, and that's really not possible under Title 42 without help from a lawyer. But there is a robust aid network on both sides of the border here that supports folks waiting. I spoke with Victor Yanez. He runs operations at a Jesuit aid center called the Kino Border Initiative on the Mexican side of the border. He told me Title 42 forces migrants to wait in these border towns, where they can become easy targets for organized crime. This week, he and his staff expected to give them some news of a reprieve.
They were very hopeful that Title 42 was coming down, that somebody's listening to them, that now they get to have this right, you know, restore. And that was not the case today. And so they're often hearing the same rhetoric and the same message over and over again that, not yet, not yet. We do not see you as a human being just yet.
Wow, and therein lies the limbo. How many people are waiting there now? What was the situation like, say, yesterday?
Right. So Yanis is the center where he is serving some 400 to 500 people a day. It's a stretch for capacity there, but he says they are handling it. But that confusion about what's happening next is definitely on everyone's mind. For asylum seekers waiting, it just kind of throws everything further out of whack. I spoke with a Guatemalan woman named Hilda who came to Nogales with her two young daughters. She told me they left home 3 months ago, fleeing a violent husband who almost killed her. One of her daughters needs special medicine for epilepsy, and she's worried they won't be able to get into school here. She wants to be with her sister in Colorado and thought the lifting of Title 42 would finally provide that opportunity. She told me learning about the court decision this week, she honestly doesn't know what she's going to do if they can't make it to the U.S.
Yo ando con mis hijas, ellas son pequeñas, son menores, y yo estoy en la obligación de protegerlas, y me siento incapaz, o sea...
So she says she has an obligation to protect her small daughters, but she feels incapable of doing that and giving them what they need, you know, things like security, health, and happiness.
So, Lisa, what is the next step for migrants like Hilda?
Well, right now, lawyers and aid workers are just telling people to continue hunkering down at this point. They say legal aid will continue as it has been, and lawyers will continue trying to help people with the most desperate cases get to bypass Title 42 and enter the U.S. And the Biden administration has asked the court to let Title 42 end, but not until the 27th of this month, at least. It says it needs the extra days to prepare. So it's really a big waiting game to see what's next.
Elisa Resnick is a reporter for KJZZ in Phoenix, speaking with us today from Nogales, Mexico, updating us on the latest on Title 42 and migrants waiting to arrive in the United States to apply for asylum. Elisa, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
According to the Paris-based NGO Reporters Without Borders, more than 1,000 journalists have been killed in the past decade simply for doing their job. Investigative journalists have been one of the main targets of this violence. Thanks to a new organization, though, when those reporters are killed, it doesn't necessarily mean their investigative work is over. From Paris, Rebecca Rossman has more about this group that is picking up the pieces across the globe.
January 7th, 2015 was the day that changed everything for Laurent Richard. The investigative journalist walked into work late that morning, only to discover the office next door had just been violently attacked.
And I was the very first person to arrive on the scene.
Minutes earlier, two brothers working for Al-Qaeda stormed into the magazine Charlie Hebdo and killed 12 people as revenge after the magazine published cartoons making fun of the Prophet Muhammad. Although he didn't work for Charlie Hebdo, they were his friends and fellow journalists.
That was happening in a country that is a democracy where journalists and cartoonists were killed for their work. So that changed entirely my vision and my life.
Things had already been stressful for Richard. He had been working on a big investigation on government corruption in Azerbaijan, for which he had received threats. So he took a sabbatical, thanks to a Knight Wallace Fellowship at the University of Michigan. That's where he got to thinking.
I tried to think about what I can do now, what I can do as a journalist to keep the stories alive of others who have been killed for their work.
His idea turned into Forbidden Stories, a network of journalists whose mission is to make sure no investigation is left unpublished, no matter what happens to the journalist under threat.
When a journalist is killed, the story most of the time is disappearing with him. And so what we try to do with Forbidden Stories is to ensure the survival of the stories.
To date, they've collaborated with more than 80 journalists in 10 countries.
Collaboration makes sense because you have more protection, more resources, and more impact.
Even if he admits that mentality tends to go against the lone wolf instincts many journalists are raised with. Forbidden Stories' first project launched in 2018. The goal was to finish the work of Maltese journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia. She became a household name in Malta for investigations into corruption and money laundering in her home country. Some even referred to her as the one-woman WikiLeaks. Matthew Caruana Galizia is Daphne's son.
She didn't just have the ability to expose wrongdoing, but she could also make people laugh at the people who are responsible for that wrongdoing. And I guess this is what made her dangerous.
Daphne was killed in October 2017 after a bomb placed under her car was detonated while she was driving near her home. Several months later, Matthew and his two brothers handed over his mom's work to the team Forbidden Stories.
We realized that they were people that we could trust and that they were serious about taking these investigations forward.
In April 2018, they published The Daphne Project.
It brought my mother back to life by bringing her investigations back to life. So I really, really think it sent a strong message, and it gave my family and anyone working for justice for my mother a huge, I mean, enormous boost that helped us keep going.
Today, Forbidden Stories takes things a step further. Journalists in danger can now share their work via a virtual safe box. If anything happens to them, they know Forbidden Stories will be able to pick up their work. And that means killing the journalist won't kill the story. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
More stories still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. In the northern part of rural Vermont, a former nursing home has been turned into a shelter for refugees from Ukraine. It is a lifeline with a catch. They can only stay in Vermont for 2 years.
We don't know about our future, what will we, what next, we don't know. We are Ukrainian, we are tough.
Their story still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Over the past 12 months, the Drug Enforcement Administration says it seized enough fentanyl to kill every person living in the United States and more, enough for 379 million lethal doses. That's twice last year's amount. The DEA is blaming a majority of the trafficking on Mexican drug cartels. Journalist Sam Quiñones has written multiple books on drug trafficking and the new era of synthetic drugs in America. He joins us from Nashville. Sam, it is a headline that stops you in your tracks. Enough seizure in a year of this contraband fentanyl to kill a population greater than the U.S. Where is all this fentanyl coming from?
It's coming from Mexico. It's made in Mexico with ingredients that are imported from abroad, mainly China, I would say India to some degree as well. Most of this is made in Mexico, and the knowledge base down there now of how to make fentanyl is fairly widespread now.
And the seizures by the DEA in the past year double that of last year. Why is it so hard to stop?
Well, because we are in a period where there's very little to no collaboration between the two governments. You're seeing now an era, really, of some of the least amount of collaboration between the countries as we've seen in probably 20 years, beginning with the inauguration of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the president of Mexico, at the end of 2018.
What role has all that played, that political aspect of the story?
There's no investigative resources being put to finding out where these chemicals are coming from, preventing them from getting into the wrong hands, and attacking these drug labs. So these drug labs now have reached almost industrial proportions, understanding that they really run no risk from investing lots of money in putting together these labs, which now are able to produce just, again, staggering quantities of these drugs. So you were seeing in the last several years something that was already happening, but has just significantly increased, it seems to me, is just the production capacity of Mexican illegal drug producers, given the fact that they have unlimited access to precursor chemicals coming from across the world.
I mean, looking at one troubling statistic, it's estimated that 196 Americans die each day from fentanyl overdoses. How did fentanyl become so deadly in this country?
Well, fentanyl is deadly when used inappropriately. It's actually a fantastic drug when used surgically and have been used surgically since the early 60s. It's a wonderful painkiller. It's a fantastic drug to use. Paramedics use it all the time. The problem is it's so potent when the wrong hands being the Mexican trafficking world and, of course, local street dealers in the United States who don't know what they're doing. There's a saying on the street, there's no such thing as a long-term street fentanyl user. It doesn't matter what your tolerance. Eventually, you're going to hit a mix that's bad, and you will die.
And the dizzying numbers just from the past year, U.S. federal agencies, 50 million pills containing fentanyl, 10,000 pounds of fentanyl powder. If that much was seized, how much do you think was not seized?
Oh, who knows? Oh, my goodness. I don't know anybody who would actually hazard an accurate guess on that. I would say, generally, it's you're seizing, what, like 10 to 20% in a good year, maybe, of what gets through. So you can do the math from there.
Sam, how do you think the U.S. and Mexico can work better together to attack this problem?
I would say that they just have to work together. I mean, there's just no collaboration at all. They were doing some good stuff. The Mexican Marines were doing some really good stuff until Andrés Manuel López Obrador shut them down back in early 2019 when he came to power. We're talking about a point now where there's literally no attempt to collaborate at all. There's no really attempt to see how we can work together or resuscitate the ways that we're working before and maybe multiply them. The symptom of all of that is the announcement by DEA yesterday of how much of the stuff they're seizing. And then, of course, by extrapolation, how much of it also must be getting into the country that they're missing.
So why isn't Mexico's President López Obrador doing more? Or why does it seem he's not taking on this problem or even looking to Washington for a stronger partnership?
Well, you'd have to ask him that, I suppose. I mean, my feeling is that he has a certain philosophy, which is abrazos, no balazos, hugs, not bullets, meaning a softer approach to drug trafficking. I would be fine with the abrazos part of it. It seems to me to be certainly necessary down in Mexico. But when you say there's going to be no enforcement, essentially, which is, I think, what they've done, the trafficking world takes that as a complete green light. Now you can invest as much as possible to make your factory capacity as large as possible. You can bring in all these chemicals because you know you're not going to be bothered.
Do you think this historic seizure and the record deaths will be a wake-up call for the U.S. government to do more?
I certainly hope so. I don't believe that any president of the last 6 or 8 years has spent the kind of time and effort on this topic. It's coast to coast. It's an unprecedented thing that traffickers from Mexico have covered the country with these two drugs, methamphetamine and fentanyl. No president so far that I've seen has really spent the time and effort that needs to be put into developing the kind of collaboration with Mexico in pushing that country. And also, I have to say this, in doing something about the weapons that are bought in the United States that are then smuggled south that help ensure the impunity of those traffickers and the symptom of which, again, the huge amounts of seizures and other drugs coming into the country.
Writer Sam Quiñones, his latest book is called The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. Sam, good to have you with us today. Really appreciate it.
Great to be with you, Marco. Thanks so much.
Ukrainians fleeing the war have the option of coming to the U.S. for 2 years under one condition. They have to have a sponsor who can financially support them. In one small Vermont town, an American couple has found a way to sponsor more than 30 Ukrainian adults and children. Many of them have developmental disabilities or medical needs. Michaela Lefrak with Vermont Public Radio has our story.
Derby, Vermont is a town of fewer than 5,000 people, just shy of the Canadian border. There's a light brown building there that used to be a nursing home. It's now a refugee center run by Teresa and Scott Cienciolo.
I'm Teresa. It's nice to meet you. Welcome to our house.
Teresa and Scott are the kind of couple that holds hands with each other when they talk. They run Agape Ministries, a Christian nonprofit that works with Ukrainians with developmental disabilities. They adopted twin boys with Down syndrome from Odessa many years ago, and they have another adopted son with autism. For years, they've been going back and forth between the U.S. and Ukraine, doing missionary work and supporting families there. When the war broke out, they followed the U.S. government's advice and evacuated in February.
We had to really reflect on what was next. And so we as people of faith, we just really prayed and fasted, and we felt somebody from our board of directors really had this great idea, said, you need to open up a refugee center.
They decided to do it. They set their eyes on the former nursing home in Derby. The bones were there, but it needed a lot of work. And they needed money.
We had $1,000 in our checking account when we came home, and we looked at the $750,000 property, and we were like, there's no way we can do it. The home had no showers. It had this very, very small kitchen. It wasn't really used as much for the residents here. And we were like, how are we going to make $750,000 and put in eight?
They raised the money from community members, grants, and churches across the country. Plumbers, electricians, and contractors volunteered their time and supplies to renovate it. And they added accessible showers and baths. Next up, filling that home with people. They started getting back in touch with Ukrainian parents of children and young adults with developmental disabilities, like Oleg and Tetiana Nadkornichi. They have two sons, a 15-year-old with autism and a 9-year-old. They're from the city of Rivne.
We live in a big city.
Yes.
No, big city, it's 300,000 people.
Yes.
You can buy anything.
Yeah.
It's an adjustment living in a small town and living alongside 36 other people. It's cold here, and Agape is geographically isolated. You can't really get anywhere without a car. But mostly, the couple says they're happy their kids are safe. And at least one kid there reports loving all the Vermont maple syrup. Oleg's now trying to get a work permit, and he's practicing for his driving test.
We don't know about our future, what will be.
Yeah.
Because we have this program only for 2 years. Mm-hmm. What next? We don't know. We are Ukrainian. We are tough.
Their kids are taking English classes from volunteer teachers who come by every day. Volunteer nurses visit, too. The residents have a wide range of needs, but under their visas, they have access to Medicaid. Teresa lists off some of the residents' conditions.
We have kids with intellectual disability, kids with autism, kids with shunts, hydrocephalus, seizure disorders, kids that need skin grafts. We have adults with gender disorders very similar to Lou Gehrig's. So we have quite a spectrum.
When I visit, three residents in their early 20s are rehearsing for an upcoming concert at a local art center to benefit Agape. Joseph from Zaporizhia plays the guitar, while two Oleksandras, one from Odessa and the other from Zaporizhia, harmonize. Oleg Nadkornichi says it's not just the Cienciolos who helped his family. It's a whole community.
It's most important for that our kids it's safe. And thanks for the government of Vermont who comes, support us
for benefits,
for all of this.
Yes, thanks. It's very important for start.
Yes, it's very, very important.
Yeah.
Scott and Teresa Cienciolo say there are 9 more Ukrainians set to arrive in Derby in the coming weeks. They're planning to open a second center nearby. For The World, I'm Michaela Lafrak, Derby, Vermont.
Tensions are on the rise in Kosovo. Protests, road blockades, a Serbian paramilitary group with alleged ties to Russia is gathering at the border. The trigger for all of this, as banal as it may seem, license plates. To unpack what's going on, I'm joined by Ramadan Ilazi in Kosovo's capital, Pristina. He's head of research at the Kosovar Center for Security Studies. Ramadan, help us understand why all this is happening and what license plates have to do with this.
So basically, the Serbian community that lives in Kosovo was using car plates issued by the Serbian government. And these car plates were, in a way, against the legal regulations in Kosovo. The government decided to end the right for the Kosovo Serbs to use car plates issued by Serbia. And this triggered reactions by Kosovo Serbs, especially in the north of the country, because they saw this decision as an act that would further diminish the Serbian presence in Kosovo.
The north of Kosovo, it's majority Serb, correct?
Yes. So right now the situation is very tense. We have the Serbian population there erecting barricades across the major roads. We had the Kosovo Serbs that were part of the police institution of Kosovo resigning en masse. So the situation in the north is quite tense and quite serious, I would say, with high potential for violence. But the good news is we have NATO troops in the country. We have Kosovo forces, so-called K4.
And remind us why NATO troops are in Kosovo.
So during the 90s, we had a brutal war for dissolution of Yugoslavia. And as a result of the wars that we had in the region, we saw the biggest massacre in Europe after World War II in Srebrenica, which was decided by the International Court that it is an act of genocide. And then we saw also in Kosovo a similar pattern of violence with ethnic cleansing campaigns. So NATO intervened to end that. And it did so successfully.
This is a complex region, to put it mildly.
Yes.
Briefly remind us of the main groups and the historic tensions over the past few years and what that means today for the state of play in Kosovo.
So basically, the main conflict was an ethnic conflict. And in Kosovo particularly, it was a conflict between Albanians and Serbs. Kosovo is predominantly Albanian. But when Kosovo declared its independence in 2008, it was only recognized on the condition that it would be a multi-ethnic state. But so far, power-sharing formulas between Albanians and Serbs and other communities have worked in some part of the country, but have not in others. For example, majority of Serbs in Kosovo live in the south part of the country, where there is a larger degree of integration.
So last week, Serbia sent a formal request to NATO to allow 1,000 security personnel into the majority Serbian region of Kosovo in their north.
Yes.
What is the status of that, and what role would NATO troops actually serve?
So the NATO troops have the mandate to guarantee a safe and secure environment. Now, Serbia has sent this request to have 1,000 members of their military to be allowed to be in Kosovo. While the request has been submitted by Serbia, the reactions from NATO member states, like United States, have been clear that they will not respond positively to such a request. Because if that would be the case, then I think we would definitely see a return of conflict in Kosovo.
There's also this Serbian paramilitary group, Narodne patrole, which is reportedly amassing on the border with Kosovo. Who are they exactly? What are they doing? Yeah.
So there is a number of groups, some of them even with ties with Russian groups such as Wagner, who have openly demanded that they be allowed to march to Kosovo. And these groups are highly nationalistic groups, also with links with far right in Europe. These are the kind of groups that would want to go back to the Milosevic ideas of ethnic cleansing, basically removing anyone from Kosovo that does not fulfill their criteria of identity, which is grounded on Orthodox Christian Serbian identities.
Do you have any sense of how Kosovo can de-escalate tensions in this majority Serbian region in the north?
The Kosovo government has taken the first step of postponing local elections in the north. It is not taking any unilateral actions. I think the way forward is for our government to refrain from doing anything that would further exacerbate or increase the tension in the north. because right now I think any actions by the government can be seen as provocative. So I would advise that the government sends reconciliatory messages, tries to talk to the Kosovo Serbs, tries to listen to the concerns of the everyday citizens in the north, but also moves forward with implementation of some of the agreements that were reached in Brussels, like establishment of an association of Serb-majority municipalities. There are concrete steps that the government can take, and most importantly, I think, listen to the advice of the United States and the European Union, who are very much invested in making sure this region is moving in the right direction, which is membership in the EU and NATO.
That's Ramadan Ilazi, head of research at the Kosovar Center for Security Studies, speaking with us about increasing tensions in Kosovo with Serbia and Serbian groups in the north of Kosovo. He joined us from Pristina, the capital of Kosovo. Ramadan, we'll keep watching this situation. Thank you very much for filling us in on the latest.
Thank you so much, Marco. I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
The story arc of COVID in China over the past 2 months is pretty remarkable. It doesn't feel that long ago that China's zero COVID policy looked something like this. In this video from the north of China in late November, long lines of people were spaced 6 feet apart, the queue ribboning back and forth in the middle of a snowstorm. People were waiting to get tested for COVID and being whipped by the wind. Snow was actually gathering on their shoulders, all to comply with the country's strict COVID testing protocols. Then, of course, came the protests.
Xi Jinping! Xi Jinping!
Protesters taking the unprecedented step of calling for Chinese leader Xi Jinping to step down, some of the most intense protests in China in decades. The government relented. Suddenly, China's zero COVID policy was no more, and it was time for a sudden return to normalcy. Journalist Roger Vicente walked through the Solana shopping mall in Beijing and tweeted videos of what he saw. Stores open, but eerily empty. A little girl ice skating on a deserted rink. Officially, the number of reported cases remains remarkably low in China, about 2,000 to 3,000 cases a day, tiny numbers for a country of 1.4 billion. Epidemiologists say it's very hard to know the true numbers of cases or deaths. There is, however, a daily stream of videos and images flooding the internet in China that provides some indication of how things are going now. And it's grim. This video pans across a hospital ward. Patients are on beds, squeezed in side by side by side. As the camera pans, it lands on an older woman sitting in a chair, upright. She looks out of it, head lolling forward and to the side. On Monday, China officially announced just 2 deaths from COVID countrywide. Around the same day, a video came online from a funeral parlor. On the black marble floor, you can see yellow and orange body bags. Around 50 are visible. Today, the director of the World Health Organization urged China to provide more detailed information about the outbreak. Beijing's most recent figure on the number of people who have died since the start of the pandemic, some 3 years ago, 5,241. Noticeably, that number released today is lower than yesterday's figure. The Chinese government said they made an error in a previous report. With Christmas just around the corner, some of your favorite foods will soon be giving way to empty grocery store shelves. You don't want to miss out on that ham or eggnog or that vegan Christmas roast. In France, they're already contending with one culinary crisis, a shortage of foie gras, that creamy and often grueling preparation of goose or duck liver. It's a must-have at French holiday tables. Reporter Jerry Haddon has our story from Ayr in southwest France.
Imagine Thanksgiving without turkey. That's sort of what a French Christmas without foie gras would be like. It's a big deal. And yet...
Non, je vais pas en acheter. Non.
Pourquoi pas? In a farmer's market in the shadow of the French Pyrenees, shopper Catherine Olive tells me she can't afford foie gras this year. I may have some on Christmas, she says, but only because I'm going to my parents' house for dinner. This store, A la Laiterie, has a small selection of classic fresh foie gras, but also semi-cooked or with spicy pepper and jars of foie gras preserves. But the prices have more than doubled this year. Some of these products will now set you back some $70 a pound. Marie-Ange Combe-Passé manages the store. This year the prices are up, she says, showing me her selection. We've had a problem with bird flu in southern France, she says. It's complicated things for the ducks.
Conséquence de la décision du ministère de l'Agriculture.
And for those who raise them. Last winter's bird flu was all the news here in France. The government ordered tens of millions of ducks culled to stop the disease's spread. Fewer ducks today translates into higher prices for their coveted livers. And this with the French already hit by high inflation.
Un petit peu moins, oui, un petit peu moins quand même.
But Crombe Passé is optimistic. She says folks are still buying just in smaller quantities. Last year, they would have taken home a large jar, she says. This year, they're grabbing the small ones. Crombe Passé says she thinks she'll make it through the foie gras season relatively unscathed, but duck farmers themselves are less sure. At a tiny duck farm a few miles down the road, 29-year-old Baptiste de la Barba says getting into the foie gras business was the worst decision of his life. I bought this place in 2020, he says, just before COVID-19 hit. I had it all. But between COVID and the bird flu, my future has crumbled. We'll see how long we can hold out, he says. De la Barba spreads hay inside his barn for his roughly 400 ducklings. He's got a little shop out front, but he says few folks pop in. He thinks they've been scared off by all the news around the high prices. So he's forced to get in his van and drive for hours, trying to sell his foie gras directly to restaurants.
Et donc je cherche des gens à le vendre de suite. Donc là, j'ai peut-être trouvé un restaurateur qui me prendrait 2 à 5 kilos semaine.
I'm trying to sell from 5 to 15 pounds a week of fresh foie gras to restaurants, he says. But the hardest part is finding buyers who keep their word. They ask for a certain amount, he says, but then they reduce their orders. Chefs in France and beyond say they have to, that they're not immune to the high prices. At an upscale restaurant in Barcelona called Tram Tram, chef Isidre Soleil says not only is the French foie gras he normally buys way more expensive, the quality has dropped.
Es había extra, primera, segunda. Ahora te venden lo que sea.
Before you had more to choose from, he says. We had categories of foie gras going from the highest quality on down. Now they just sell you anything. It's crazy, he says. You can end up with foie gras with blood stains and lots of veins. As a result, Soleil says he's only using foie gras as a garnish this year on other dishes. But not everyone sees the foie gras crisis as a bad thing. Animal rights activists like these in Paris have long called for an outright ban on foie gras because to make it, you have to force feed the fowl. It's called gavage in French. And the activists say it's cruel. To wit, farmers pump large amounts of feed directly into the birds' bellies, which causes the birds' livers to enlarge and fatten. Back at the duck farm in southern France, farmer Baptiste de la Barba says, as with all animal raising, there's a right way and a wrong way. I've never had a problem, he says. I've got a lot of friends who come by, expecting the worst, but I show them how we do the gavage. When you do it well, he says, they and the duck barely even notice. What people would notice, de la Barba says, is a holiday season without the fruits of his labor.
Les gens choisissent le foie gras,
people choose foie gras, he says. It's like whiskey or beer in Ireland. It's exactly the same, he says, just a bit more expensive. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Air France.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We're back with you tomorrow. Before we go, I want to remind you that we are nearing the end of our fall fundraiser. We have until December 31st, but we're still short of our goal. We won't get there without your help. Every gift will get us one step closer. Make your donation to support our human-centered reporting today at theworld.org/give. Thanks so much. From PRX.